Welcome to The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. Here's your host, Jeff Nadeau.
What's up, everybody, and welcome in to another edition of The Sit Down, a mafia history podcast. I am your host, Jeff Nadeau. Hope you're having a great night wherever you are. It is time for that time of the week that we all look forward to. Another episode of The Sit Down is here. And we got a really good show today planned for you. I get the question all the time. I get this DM'd me. I get, you know, Twitter spaces, really anywhere that you have these people that don't know much about the mob, or even people that do know a lot about the mob, they'll ask me, is the mob still around today? It surely is. And we're going to talk a little bit about it today. We're going to talk about one of the most powerful people, at least in the eyes of the federal government in the entire country when it comes to the mob. According to the government, the alleged head of the Genovese crime family. We're going to talk about Barney Bellomo today. A lot of people don't know who Barney is. They don't know anything about him. But if I told you, Blackjack Fletcher, our co-host, that he was one of the more powerful people in America when it comes to the mafia right now, would you believe me?
Looking at photographs of him, I would say no. He doesn't quite resemble some of the titans of years past.
Yeah, but as we know, the Genovese crime family has really been the Ivy League, the top-level family for many years, and it's become that way because of shrewd decisions, front bosses, and things of that nature. And Barney really, from the beginning of his life, was a born leader. He was definitely the guy that I think was the next in line once Chin and others we've either died or went to prison. So we'll get into that in just a little bit. I know a lot of the new fans will enjoy that. But before we do that, we're going to do a little Q&A. We haven't done a Q&A in a while, and we got some really good questions this week. But I got to ask, Blackjack, how's everything going? Good to have you back for another episode. How's the weather down in sunny Florida?
Fantastic, Jeff. I mean, we're getting to be wintertime, so we're dipping into the 50s at night, you know, getting chilly, fireplaces getting fired up.
Well, it is, you know, it is 35 degrees here right now. So
it's about 65 here. So
it's definitely cold. It's getting colder. I know that. It's weird because I go to the gym 4 days a week, and then I have 3 days a week where I just do cardio outside. And that's kind of always how I did cardio. And in Philly, there's a big Muslim population, and they have these headscarves that you can buy. And I bought one because it's great to wrap around your head to keep yourself warm. And for the first time, I found myself wearing it this week. I hadn't had it out in months, but it was cold, man. You got to get out there and work around, and it's cold. You know, it's definitely nippy, but glad to see you're doing well.
How's your training coming for your big fight?
Training's great. I was actually just on the phone with my dad about it. And yeah, you know, today I had probably, I'm recording this on Tuesday the 16th. I had probably the best day I've had yet today. It was great. I mean, we are really getting into really the things that I need to work on and be ready for, which is footwork, you know, moving around. You wouldn't believe how easy it is to get your feet tangled, your legs tangled up. It's important to move the right way, have your footing correct. Actually also took a shot in the face today, which was nice, felt good. I'm turning into a hardened boxer.
I like it. I was on Amazon earlier today doing some Christmas shopping. I think I found the perfect present for Jersey Jerry. I'm going to send him a box of 200 straws because it's going to be the only way that idiot can eat for a few months after we come with him.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. We'll hope. But yeah, our goal is to win the fight. And we are about, you know, a little under 3 weeks away. So that'll be great. I want to set the stage now. The week of December 10th, we will not have a show. I think you all can understand that. We have been here for about 6 months straight, but I am actually going to be traveling that day. We will be back the next week. We're actually going to have a special episode the week of the 18th. Obviously, if you know anything about Cosa Nostra, you know what happened on December 16th, 1985, the hit on Paul Castellano. We're going to talk about that hit. I'm working, Blackjack, on hopefully getting someone that was in the restaurant during that hit, which is pretty incredible. A listener reached out to me, so I'm going to see if I can't tie that down. But as always, we appreciate you listening to the show. So just keep that in mind. The week of December 10th, we will not have a show. But as always, thanks for checking us out. You can follow us on Twitter at the Sit Down 7. Make sure if you ever hear any ads on our show, make sure you go support those people. That's how we keep this show free. And you can check us out on YouTube as well. The Sit Down is on YouTube as well. Blackjack, let's get into some Q&A. We've got some good questions this week. And we'll start it out with Stephen Kelly. He says, would you be able to further explain why Carlo Gambino is pushing for the books to be closed from 57 to 1976 when he died? I know his thought process was not making someone who may be an informant. Do you ultimately think that closing the books was bad for the mob? Well, look, he closed the books because after Apalachin, there was a big embarrassment in the mafia, and there was a lot of worry about what was going on behind the scenes. Were there some detractors in the midst? So they closed the books. But obviously, again, people die over a 20-year period. You got to start bringing in new blood. And Carlo had actually considered one point at consolidating all the families into one big Gambino family, from what I understand. And, you know, he really wanted control of the entire Borgata. Now, that never happened, obviously. But, yeah, I think he was just worried about informants. And ultimately, the problem there was you weren't inserting in any new blood, and that needed to end at some point. And when he died, I think everyone was happy along the lines that they could at least open up the books again. So, yeah, I mean, pretty simple.
Yeah, I think the other thing, too, that's a consideration is, as much as you just said about the Genovese family being kind of the Ivy League of the five families, the Gambinos have always been the biggest, right? Like it was a very large family in terms of number of people involved. I don't know that there was necessarily the need during that time people to bring new blood in. As we got to the end of it, certainly there was, but I think for a while they were just fine to work off of what they had.
Yeah, Bruce Mao, who's part of the FBI and was integral in bringing down the Gambinos, he actually made a comment one time that was really dead on the money. He mentioned that, quote, they didn't trust the new generation. They liked the old paisans. It's the dinosaur theory. They didn't like anything new. And look, ultimately, that was the way they needed to be, because what we saw with the mob that happened over the course of the 80s into the 90s is, back in the day, let's say in the 40s or the 50s, the 60s, there was a credit check for, not literally a credit check, but there was a check on people of who you were. Were you Italian? Could you be substantiated? Eventually, the mob just got super greedy and was letting anyone and everyone join. And ultimately, you started seeing rats pop up. Obviously, the golden age of the mob was the 50s and the 60s when they actually brought in the right people. They trusted each other. They trusted the code. So obviously the new breed of gangster was something that ended up bringing down the mob in general. Tony Hooligan, what were some of the things guys loved or known for in regards to food? Any famous dishes? That's a fascinating question. I have no idea. There are a few things I do know, though, about per se food. I know that when John Gotti was in control of the Bergen Hunt and Fish Club, there was a longstanding tradition on Saturday evenings to have a sausage and pasta dinner. It was it was a special made sauce that actually Bobby Borriello was known for, who was John's bodyguard and driver for a long period of time. The cook in those days was a guy called Dom Pizzonia, skinny Dom Pizzonia. He was actually involved with the hit on Paul Castellani, who's one of the backup shooters. He was a terrific cook, from what I understand. And they were very famous. They were like almost like a conference every Saturday night. You go there, you have a nice meal, and that's that. As far as food, though, I mean, there were definitely people that were involved with restaurants and things of that nature. What they ate, I know Tony or Carmen Galanti was eating linguine and clams, I believe, at Joe and Mary's when he got whacked. Yes.
Yep.
But yeah, I don't know the takeout orders for the Palma Boys Social Club. What do you think Tony Salerno would eat regularly? That's an interesting question.
Anything?
Yeah, yeah. That's
anything
true.
Would be my guess.
Yeah, he was quite fat. But yeah, I don't know. That's a good question, but none that I know of. All right. Did the Chin Gigante completely drop the Odd Father Act when he was eventually found guilty? And if so, did he run prison with him still the boss of the family? Thanks. Well, look, we're going to talk a little bit about that today in the Barney Belomo episode, who, if you know anything about Chin, he was very fond of Barney Belomo. As far as did he drop the crazy act? Yeah, I would imagine. It kind of been put out there that he wasn't exactly nuts. And look, I've heard in certain instances that even in court, you know, right before he was found guilty, he had dropped it even at that point.
Yes.
So, I would have to imagine. Yeah, he definitely did. Now, did he control the family? No. I mean, once he went away, he had already instituted someone as the new front boss. In fact, there's actually rumors that 2 years prior to his incarceration, he had already established a new acting street boss. So, no, I mean, between Dom Cirillo and Matty Ioniello and Barney Baloma, they were kind of in control of the family. Now, Chin was still very much involved, but as he got older and as he got in poorer health, he was not as in control. But yeah, I couldn't imagine he acted nuts behind the walls. That was all an elaborate.
No, and I think, Jeff, you hit it on the head when you, once he was convicted, I think you see that veil kind of fall. Like he, I think it's pretty clear that he dropped the act at that point once he knew what was coming.
Yeah, 100%. What do you feel is the most interesting decade to study when it comes to OC? That's a good question. I don't know. I would probably say the 80s, you know, like the late 70s into the late 80s, like that kind of time. You know, obviously you had a lot going on. There was a lot of things that were happening. I always found to be like the end of the Salerno episode. So basically the high level commission bosses, whether it was Corallo, Castellano, Salerno, Giganti, then into Joey Messina, like that area is kind of my favorite. I've always enjoyed, you know, Philadelphia with Nicky Scarfo and that group. You know, I honestly as well, like, you know, some of my favorite episodes we did were, you know, Cabani Savage. I've always enjoyed like the Black Mafia stuff in Philly. What about you, Blackjack? What would you find?
It's funny. I didn't think you were going to say that. I thought you would have gone earlier, but I would say the 80s as well, because yeah, as much as I think the golden era was the 50s and 60s, the money that was being thrown around in the 80s is staggering and ultimately is what I think led to the downfall of the mob. It also, the 80s just features such big characters, right? Like you've still got Carlo around, then Castellano takes over. You've got, you know, Neil, Della Croce, Gotti is on the come up. Like the 80s to me is just a fascinating time in American mafia. Also just because it's kind of relatable. I know we're sitting here in 2021 and it's, you know, 35, 40 years ago. It doesn't feel that long ago, but it's a relatable time frame. And there was just so much going on.
Yeah. I mean, there was a ton of action. I mean, everything from the John Gotti era, the kid on Castellano, the Donnie Brasco situations, Carmen Galanti hit. You know, there's just so much action. I mean, every family was at its highest level.
The Columbos are killing each other. I mean,
yes,
the norm, yeah. But
they were in their 8,000th war. Yeah. And you mentioned the money. I mean, obviously you have, you know, the Concrete Club, you have construction, you have the unions, you have things like Lufthansa, you know, just gigantic money. And look, again, like my favorite mobsters of all time are Giganti and Salerno. So, you know, that time when they were boss and front boss, I mean, it was high level. It's that simple. Jersey Girl, thank you for listening as always. I appreciate it. Was Henry Hill really what he was portrayed to be in Goodfellas? Well, you know, I think this question, a lot of people would want to jump and say, well, no, he wasn't. He was more of a lackey. I don't know if he was completely what they made him out to be in the show or in the movie, but a lot of the movie was pretty valid. I mean, they didn't obviously bring up the fact that, you know, Henry Hill was in the military. A lot of people don't know that. He actually joined the United States Army. He was involved with Lufthansa. I don't think you can't say he wasn't. Nope. He obviously was involved with the point shaving scheme at BC, which wasn't included in the film. You know, but I would say the film portrayed him better than he was. I don't think he was like this.
Yeah.
He made him seem like he was like third in command in Lucchese crime.
I think that as with any movie where you have somebody who is participating in the making of that movie, they're going to make themselves look a little bit better than they maybe were. However, I do think that Martin Scorsese did a fairly good job of showing the negative side of Henry Hill as well. So I think the movie is fairly accurate, not entirely, but anything else that Henry Hill says after the movie is all bullshit.
Yeah, we did a show on Jimmy Burke. It's one of our most popular episodes. We're definitely going to do a show. And, you know, there's a guy that gets no love in that group. Paul Verrio is incredibly powerful, made a lot of money. They were a really high level crew. You know, they were doing a lot of shit on the street, but you know, Paul Verrio was a very rich man. I mean, he did a lot of things. They were bringing in a lot of money for the Lucchese. So yeah, you know, we always look at film and Hollywood, and they're always going to blow things out of proportion. But generally, when you watch a film, it's not like they make Frank Sheeran out to be like the best hitman in the history.
It's not a documentary, right? It's not a documentary.
Sure. Exactly. Mike Murphy, why do you say Capone was in the mafia? Was Chicago not considered mafia? Yeah, we've said that multiple times. There was no crime family when Al Capone was in control. It was called it's called the Outfit, and it was it wasn't as organized as the Outfit we know of when Accardo was in control or someone else. It was a gang. That's what it was during those times. It was a gang. Chicago, and look, Al Capone was definitely involved with people in New York and stuff, but there wasn't as much established organization there. Al Capone didn't get his fingerprint. He wasn't made in the mafia. He was a gangster.
Listen, if Prohibition doesn't happen, Al Capone is a street criminal for the most part. Okay. Yeah. Prohibition made Al Capone who he was. I don't know.
A lot of people who he was.
Absolutely. But I don't know that Al Capone, you can't put Al Capone in the same class as Carlo Gambino. You just can't.
No. Al Capone is very overrated in the grand scheme. Like I've said many times, like if you go up to like 50 people in the street, 45 will say Al Capone when you mention the mafia, either Al Capone or John Gotti. And it's like, well, okay, that's fair. But I mean, they're really not that successful in the grand scheme of things.
Well, I'll say this. I think Gotti was far more successful than Capone was. But I mean,
look, they both made a lot of money. They were both very short lived. And there's no Al Capone was not inducted into the mafia.
Gotti was short lived as a boss. Gotti led his whole life, though, in the mafia.
Sure. He had a much longer career.
Al Capone did not have the longevity that John Gotti had.
Sure, 100%. If you're Carlo Gambino and Castellano comes crying that Gotti killed a soldier like he did in real life, obviously he's talking about Ralph Gaione after the McBratney hit, would you have made the same decision Carlo did and gave Gotti a pass, or would you have had him whacked?
It's a great question.
It is a great question. And, you know, it's funny because one of the great films that was made about the mob was the original Gotti film. And in that, if you remember,
I do.
Remember the great scene when Neil comes into the bar
and
basically says, look, you know, we live by our rules. These two zips would, you know, they would have whacked you. You know, I had to go to Don Carlo. And remember, Corrado Soprano, who played Joe Armone in the film, he had also agreed that John should go because of his inability to follow the rules. But I think if this was the case, I think Carlo probably saw something in Gotti. He trusted Neil's judgment. Neil probably said, look, I look at the guy like a son. You know, he's obviously someone that's a good earner. He's
well,
someone
we need to have. And I think if you take the Ralph Gaione thing as a whole, right? Like, first of all, the hit on McBratney was a favor to Gambino, right? It was a favor to Carlo. And Paul insisted on sending Ralph Gaione. Ralph Gaione was a cokehead. He was a nut job. And he fucked it up, okay? And Gotti still got the job done and still did the bid in prison. I don't know that you take out John Gotti over that. And I remember the scene in the movie, Jeff, you're talking about in Gotti when Neil says to him, you know, he's like a son to me and we need as many John Gottis as we can get.
Right.
Because John Gotti's a guy who lives and dies with this. And I think ultimately I would have given him the pass. It's close though. I'd say it's razor thin. Like it is razor thin because ultimately the rules, it's what Neil says to him at that scene in the bar, right? The rules are what keep us together. The rules.
Yeah.
And he makes him do a toast to the rules. And it's one of those things that it's a razor's edge. I think I would have done what Carlo did though.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Blackjack. There's actually been proof that's come out in the past couple of years that James McBratney actually had nothing to do with the kidnapping of Gambino's nephew. And well, that.
And I know what you're talking about, but whether he did or not, Carlo thought he did. Right?
Sure. No, exactly.
It's a favor to Carlo.
Sure, exactly. And you're right. I agree. I probably would have given him a pass as well. I mean, you know, it's hard to find good people. And, you know, John obviously, you know, was good people, at least in the scheme of being a good mobster, until he became boss and some things happened. But
I think John regardless, but
right. How do you think Fat Tony would have been if he was the actual boss? Also, of all bosses from the past, who do you think would be able to cut it today? Well, look, Tony made a lot of decisions. He was just not boss by name. Tony Salerno at one point probably ran this country as far as New York was concerned from a commission standpoint. If you go back and listen to wiretaps, they would go to Tony Salerno, whether it was Corallo, he would make decisions over everyone else. Really, once Carlo went away, it was almost Tony Salerno in control of things. People like Tony. They like dealing with him. And Gigante didn't want to be out there in the limelight. And, you know, obviously Gigante was very powerful behind the scenes, but Tony would have been, he was high level and he wasn't even the actual boss per se. Of the past, who do I think would be able to cut it today?
All of them. One answer.
All of them.
Well, I think the one clear answer is Tony Accardo. I think Tony Accardo would have been incredible today.
Yeah, I think Tony obviously Accardo
would have run this thing like a goddamn Fortune 500 company. He'd be up there with Bezos and Elon Musk. Like Tony Accardo would have been unbelievable today.
Well, I think any of the Genoveses would be fine. Gigante obviously was not out there, you know, in the limelight anyway, so he would have did fine. Salerno wasn't out there. I mean, most of the guys would have been fine. They would have had to went into different things, and they would have needed younger guys. Could you imagine Tony Salerno doing some of this new stuff? I mean, would he have a smartphone, you think?
Probably. Who doesn't, Jeff?
Could you imagine
Barney
him?
Barney Bellomo have a smartphone? I bet he does.
Who?
Barney Bellomo? I bet he's got a smartphone.
Oh, I'm sure he does, yeah. I'm 100% sure he does. Oh, but he was significantly younger than Tony. I mean, Tony, could you imagine him, like, sitting outside of the Palma Boys with an iPhone? I mean, that'd be fascinating. Luke Huska. Was Larry Mazza a made man? He says he was, but I've heard online speculation that he wasn't. I find it hard to believe because someone who did it as much work as him never got made. I mean, he did kill Nikki Black, which was probably the biggest hit of that Colombo War. Well, look, he was there. He didn't kill Nikki Black, as far as I know. I think it was Gregory Scarpa, but look, he was there nonetheless. There's a lot of contention about whether Larry's a made man. For anyone that doesn't know, Larry Mazza was a part of the Colombo crime family. He was basically the protege of Greg Scarpa. He's since become an informant. He's done a lot of interviews. He actually had an affair with Linda Scarpa, who was married to Greg. We talked about that during the episode. Greg then became cool with it and was just like, hey, do what you got to do. Just don't tell anybody about it. And he became very close to Larry. Larry has said that in multiple interviews that he was made in prison in a bathroom, which do I know per se? No, I do not. I don't know if Larry Mazza is telling the truth. Do I think he's lying? I've always found Larry to be kind of believable, to be honest. He's a nice guy. He sent me a book. He signed the book. He's a nice guy. Do I think he was made in a prison cell?
Listen, maybe he was, but I don't know how much clout that actually holds.
Yeah, and a lot of people have made that point. You know, they don't recognize it. And, you know, it doesn't really matter now because Larry Mazza is not in the life anymore. But just to kind of answer it, I've always found Larry to be pretty believable. That's just my thought. Whether we believe it or not, we'll probably never know. But I would say probably. But again, as Blackjack said, I don't know how much weight that really holds. Matt, who or was the most influential mobster or made man that no one talks about outside of New York and Chicago, and why? I think it's a pretty easy answer. Sonny Franzese. Sonny is extremely underrated when it comes to just overall power, the amount of people that liked him, how connected he was, how much money he made. He doesn't get talked about because he did a lot of time in prison. Remember, we did that show. Sonny is really influential. Okay, he made a lot of money. He, as I said, was very powerful. He bore a son, or allegedly bore a son. We don't know if it's actually his son. Did you know that, Blackjack, by the way, that there's a lot of contention that Michael Franzese is not actually Sonny Franzese's kid?
We have talked about that before, yeah. We've gotten into that before, yeah.
So it's, you know, but again, you know, all that leads back to Sonny. I mean, he was in the life for, what, 80 years? There was a old wives' tale that he was made at 14. Now, obviously, he wasn't, but he had been involved really for 96% of his life. And again, made a lot of money, was involved with two of the biggest films over the last 50 years in America. Very powerful, very influential, made a lot of people pissed off, but also made a lot of people very happy with the amount of money he made. Do you have an answer to that, Blackjack?
I think you hit it on the head, because honestly, when I heard the question, I thought it would be a tough one. And then as soon as you said Sonny Franzese, I thought, yep, that's it.
I would also say, and you know, people ask me all the time, you know, if you could, like, if you were able to be a level in the mob, like, what would you want to be? Would you want to be the boss? Like, would you want to be just a soldier? And I've always said, like, a soldier, because, or even an associate, like, there's no target on your back. You don't have to worry about, you know, anybody really coming after you. You can make as much money as you want. There's a guy in the Colombo family, as well as Sonny was, a guy, Ralph Scopo, little Ralphie Scopo Sr. This guy was really the creator of the Concrete Club. He was very heavily involved with unions, made a ton of money. You know, people like that are not talked about very often, but you know, they're incredibly powerful. One other guy, a lot of people don't ever talk about, and we'll do a show on him at some point. There's a guy in the Gambino family, Joe the Cat LaForte. No one will ever bring him up. Made multi-millions of dollars in real estate, like literally was in Soho before anyone else. You know, had a ton in real estate, had tons of connections, made uber amounts of money for the Gambinos. Gotti hated him though. And he was a real, like, prickly guy. So you'll never hear about him. He owned the Ravenite Social Club. He was the actual owner. There's a guy, Jimmy Napoli, probably the biggest bookmaker in the history of America, made millions. Knew Donald Trump's father. I remember at one point, Fred Trump went to Napoli and said, "Hey, you know, what do you think of my son?" He goes, "Look, tell your fucking son to stay out of this business. He's not made for it." You can look that up. He told the kid, "You're no good. Stay out of this business. It's not for you." And he went into it, and obviously it didn't work out. But yeah, there's a lot of guys under the radar, and this is why we made this show. Eventually, we'll talk about those people and not just the big boys. Okay, one more. Of all the gangsters, who do you think would have made the best president?
John Gotti.
No, stop.
Yes. Yes. Let me tell you something, Jeff. I'm just going to say this.
Maybe in the scheme of
we live in a country that is full of people that don't know how to govern. They can't get people to do things that they don't want to do. Listen, Joe Biden's got a Democratic House and Senate. He can't get his own party in line to pass a bill. Donald Trump was in office. He had people talking about they wanted to impeach him and all this shit. You know what? Give me a strong hand. Give me John Gotti in there. No one's going to cross him. He's going to get done what he wants to get done. Maybe it's good. Maybe it's bad. I don't know. But give me a strong hand. I'll take John.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of answers I think you could give here. You mentioned Accardo, who is, you know, incredibly powerful.
Tony would have been great. But I'll take John Gotti. At this point in American history, I'll take John Gotti.
Oh, yeah. I'll also go with, you know, if this was kind of a little bit, you know, 10, 20 years ago, Frank Costello. I mean, he was incredibly connected and powerful. But yeah, I get what you're saying. Let me ask you, do you equate Joe Biden to, like, Vincent Gigante?
But without the act, Joe Biden's crazy. I think Joe Biden's just old and senile. Listen, I like Joe Biden. He's been around forever. Everyone likes him. I think Joe Biden's a guy with good intentions, but he's ancient, and I think he's legitimately senile. Yes. I watched him in a town hall a month ago, Jeff, look down at the floor with his hands in his pockets and say, "What the hell am I doing here?" I don't know. You're the president. You're the leader of the free world. I don't know. Give me a guy with a firm hand.
Yeah, no.
That doesn't mean Donald Trump. It means give me a guy with a firm hand who knows what the hell he's doing.
Well, that's one thing about Trump. Like, you can say what you want about him. Like, I feel like he was pretty firm. I mean,
he was, but the problem with Trump is he was also a crazy person. Like, sure. I think John Gotti knew how to run an organization. He knew how to run things. I'll take a guy with that experience.
Sure. No, I couldn't agree with you more. Good questions, though, tonight. We did have one other question. It was a kind of a long-winded one. It was kind of picking, like, a boss, underboss, concierge, 8 capos and 8 soldiers for, like, your perfect dream team family. We'll do that at some point. Maybe we'll do a whole show around that. We'll do a
whole fantasy mafia show one day.
Yes. You know, Blackjack, you weren't here on one of the episodes. I forget which one it was. It was maybe 10 episodes ago or so. There was a great question, Blackjack, about you have to create a baseball team of mobsters.
I love that.
Yeah, it was actually really good. That. And I had
One day, Jeff, we'll do a fantasy mafia draft.
Yes.
And that's what we'll do. It'll be great.
I love it. So let's get into our biography tonight. Obviously, I said at the beginning of the show, you know, we get asked all the time, you know, what's up with the mob today? The mob's obviously in the shadows, but the five families are still very much around. There was a Colombo bust pretty recently. The Gambinos are well-oiled right now. Genovese's well-oiled. Lucchese's have a good governing body. Bonanno's are still around. These families are still around doing things. But it's the man that's heading allegedly, the Genovese family, that is really the guy that I think is truly the last of the Mohicans, really. Barney Belomo is a fascinating guy. This is a guy that was made by 20. I mean, think about that. 20. That's
staggering.
Staggering. It really is. It's a great word. And this is a guy that's really had a really interesting come up. He was born into this life, and you look at where he is today. He's having to really do a tough wire act because you know how hard it is, Blackjack, to do this line of work in this day and age. I mean, you're dealing with a lot. I mean, Tony Salerno didn't have to deal with, you know, cameras on every corner and all this crazy shit. It's a tough to be a boss nowadays. And, you know, Barney is, from what I've noticed, done a great job. So let's get into it. Barney Belomo, they call him the purple dinosaur on the sit down. Liborio Salvatore Belomo was born January 8th, 1957 in the Bronx, New York. He was the son of Salvatore Belomo. Now, Sal Belomo was a soldier in the Genovese crime family. He's very close with Tony Salerno. And as a teen, Salvatore actually died. And you know, as any kid, you know, you lose your father, particularly in the teenage years of your life. It's really tough. But there is reason to believe, and history will tell us, that before the death of Salvatore Belomo, he had obviously knew he was going to die eventually. He actually consulted to Tony Salerno and asked Tony to watch over the kid. He didn't have anybody else, you know, watch over him. He's a good kid, watch over him. And Salerno would kind of say to him, you know, we'll take care of him. He'll be fine. Belomo would actually go to business school, though. He would attend a school for just a year called the Monsignor Scanlon's Business School in the Bronx. He would study mortuary science, but it would end up leaving after just a year. By that point, he was already pretty involved with the life, as we would call it. He actually came up under a guy called Vinny the Fish Cafaro. We know that name. He would become a rat at some point, but he was actually sponsored, the guy that sponsored Barney into the family. And as I said, by 1977, at 20 years old, above a East Harlem pizzeria, Barney Belomo will be inducted into the Genovese crime family. And again, he was on his own. His family at this point was his brothers and sisters and his mob family. And it was a good family to be involved with. There were a ton, Blackjack, of powerful people in the mid-70s in the Genovese crime family.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the Genoveses, as you've said many times, were the top tier of the five families. You can argue, you know, the Gambino family, but the Genoveses really had the most stability and the most success over a long period of time. And for somebody to be inducted into that family at the age of 20 is, I mean, we just use the word staggering. In no show that we've done prior has somebody been inducted into a family of such you know, rapport at that age, it really is an incredible thing. It sets Bellomo up for a very bright future moving forward.
Yeah, we talked about the 116th Street crew during the Salerno show. That would obviously be passed down once Salerno elevates. Others would take it over. Eventually, an individual called Severio, Sammy Black Santoro, would take over the powerful crew out of East Harlem. And that's where Barney Bellomo would actually start his mob career. He would quickly, though, by 85, be elevated to acting captain. Sammy Black would actually get sick and pass the family off to Barney. He would actually elevate and pass the family off to Barney Bellomo. Again, we're looking at 87. So he's 30 years old. I'm 32. By 30 years old, he is a captain of probably the most powerful crew in New York. I mean, the 116th Street crew has a long lineage of success. I mean, there are a couple really big time crews. It was one of the best. And from what lawyers would talk about, when Santora moved on and ended up passing away, from what lawyers would talk about, there was an individual called Peter Peluso. He was actually Barney's father's lawyer and Barney's lawyer for a lot of years. He would actually say that Barney completely became a different person. He was a born leader. He was able to stay in the back behind things, but when he was called upon, he was able to take things over. And Santora groomed him well. He was his protege. And Santora knew he was perfectly capable of running the family. And the good thing for Barney was he was not only making Santora look good, but he was catching the eye of Vinny Gigante as well. He was smart. He was careful. He was capable, Blackjack. He was really the kind of guy that the books were opened for.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, listen, he had established himself. And like you said, you know, it's the thing about the Genoveses is that they are such a well-oiled machine that I think they were in a better position to recognize talent and open the books for them with less concern than some of the other families.
Yeah. And, you know, I mentioned how careful and capable he was. There's stories about Barney Bellomo about how he's always a very modest guy, right? If you've ever seen pictures of Barney, there's not many. You always see him in blue jeans, you know, maybe loafers. I mean, he looks like a dad, like a dad in America, you know, yep, going to pick up a pizza or go for a haircut. Like, he's a normal guy. You're not going to see him in suits and, you know, coiffed hair. Like, that's just not the guy he is. And he would also, there was old rumors that he was so cunning that he would, one of his big things was when he would meet with Genovese people, he would always go to black neighborhoods because he said that it was, he could always spot law enforcement a lot easier in different neighborhoods. I don't know why that is.
Well, I mean, I think it's because they stand out. If you go to a poorer neighborhood or maybe a neighborhood that's more minority controlled, cops can stand out a little bit more, right? If you're on a suburban street, how will you know if there's a guy sitting in a car in front of a house? It's not abnormal.
Yeah, and by 1990, he was a rising star. And this would be a big time for Barney Bellomo. In 1990, as we know, Vincent Gigante would be indicted in the very famous Windows case. If you remember, Peter Savino becomes a cooperator, and the housing projects are getting all new windows installed in the city of New York, and the mob's involved with this big scam. And by that point, Chin Gigante reaches down and calls on Barney Bellomo to become acting boss of the Genovese crime family. Pretty incredible. That quickly. So keep in mind, he's like 35. Like, he's 35 and the acting boss of the most powerful family in the country. Barney, again, was a G. This guy was quick, a quick riser, and by the early 90s was the leader of the family. And Barney would run the family with an iron fist. He had good people around him. That's always something that, even outside of the upper management, there was always good people around, whether it was Barney Bellomo, even the lower levels. And when we're looking at lower levels, you talk about even like Consiglieri, even the underboss. You look at the underboss during that time, you know, there was Benny Eggs Mangano early, and then eventually when Barney takes over. The leadership of the family by this point was Mickey Domino Generuso. He was the underboss of the family. Now, Mickey Domino Blackjack was an interesting guy. He was a very old, you know, seasoned guy. He had been made when Lucky Luciano was still in control of the Genoveses, back when they were the Luciano crime family. He had really had a good rapport with the younger Bellomo. He was always good as kind of second in command. Mickey Domino was always talked well about. And the consigliere of the family during this reign was a guy called James, the little guy, Ida. Now, Ida came up under Matty the Horse Iniello. He was actually Iniello's prodigy or protege, if you will. And they actually ruled the family really well. They were high level. They did a great job, and they continued to turn the wheels of the most powerful family. Now, by 1996, though, things would start to come undone a little bit for Barney Bellomo. As we know, you know, once we got into the late 80s and even into the 90s, after Gigante was taken down, or at least they thought they had taken him down, the goal was to then go after the rest of the hierarchy of the Genovese crime family. On June 11th, 1996, Barney Bellomo and many others are indicted on a 65-count indictment involving RICO, including two murders, which we'll talk about in just a second. Other people involved and arrested are Mickey Domino Generuso, Little Jimmy Ida, and other people in the Genovese crime family. Now, before we get into that case and the murders and stuff, I just want to kind of talk about the early 90s, because as we know with the Genoveses, they're always very involved in the construction industry, in unions, all sorts of stuff. And Barney Bellomo was no different. He was very involved with carpenters union, construction unions. They had tons of people on the payroll. And interestingly enough, Blackjack, in the early 90s, the New Jersey and New York State Organized Crime Task Force indicated that 100 carpenters that worked at the Javits Center had ties to organized crime, some of whom were made members of the five families. These carpenters would make hundreds of thousands of dollars, and most of them were very connected. So there was a major mob undertone in these construction unions, and the government was looking at it and saying, we got to do something about this shit. This is out of control.
Yeah, I mean, it was too much money, Jeff, and we've talked about this with, you know, the Windows case and with other things. There was just too much money being involved here that the government had no choice but to look into it. I mean, when you're it's the greed issue, right? Like when you start to get that greedy and you're talking about dollars in those numbers, the government is going to get involved one way or the other.
Yeah, what Barney started doing as well is he started putting people that he trusted and friends of his in control. He would make a friend of his, Ralph Coppola, a labor boss. And there was another individual, Anthony Fiorino, who ran Local 257. He actually once threatened a man saying, quote, your kids will be hurt if you continue to step on people's toes. He would also be responsible for making sure that not only the Gambinos, the Westies, and the Genoveses would continue to get operating money from the Javits Center and other big construction projects. So as his predecessors did, Barney would be very involved in unions. I want to talk a little bit more in 96 about these two murders that Barney Bellomo would have to deal with. And this would be a turning point in his life because, you know, he had obviously been a huge riser, a quick riser. He was very powerful. He was very much in control, and he was called upon to take the family into the next generation. And these murders weren't good. One of them would occur in January of 1991, an individual called Ralph DeSimone, who was accused of being a rat. He was found dead in a trunk at LaGuardia Airport. Now, if that last name sounds familiar, he was actually related to Tommy DeSimone. The other murder would involve a guy called Anthony Hickey DiLorenzo. DiLorenzo would be found shot in his home in West New York, New Jersey. And this would derive in a situation in the late 80s when Hickey DiLorenzo would be in prison. He'd be released, and a lot of people started acting and saying that he was acting weird. He was supposed to be moving drugs, which is a big no-no in the Genovese crime family. And little Jimmy Ida, who was the consigliere, decided that he had heard and had enough with this guy. He went to Domino and other people and said, look, this guy, he's got to go. So he assigns his brother, Joseph Ida, to take care of Hickey DiLorenzo. So both these murders would, according to the government, be stuff that Barney Bellomo did. But again, as you know, Blackjack, you were an attorney. It's the government's job to prove all this.
I mean, listen, you can make any allegation you want. Ultimately, you have to prove it. And you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt, which is a relatively high burden. And, you know, that's the way it should be, Jeff. I mean, the government, I despise nothing more than when the government takes shortcuts because they have every resource behind them. And they have a general presumption, even though, you know, we say you're innocent until proven guilty. I have stood up in a courtroom many a time with a client sitting next to me, and the prosecutor will go up in jury selection and say, do you believe that when there's smoke, there's fire? You know, do you think that people just get arrested for no reason? People are inclined to want to convict somebody. That's just how it is. So when the government takes shortcuts, it really upsets me. But yes, you can make allegations. You still have to prove them.
Yeah, and in 1996, when he would be arrested, one of the things that Bellomo would do that would really set up a problem in the family between him and some of the older members is, obviously he was younger, he was a little bit more adept at taking a plea bargain. If we remember, a lot of mobsters for many years, the old school guys, would never admit to anything. Okay, they wanted to go to trial, and if they went to jail forever, that was their thing. Barney basically goes to the FBI and says, look, I'll do a plea bargain if you drop the two murders. Now, independent lie detector tests would come in, and Barney and Mickey Domino Generuso would both be given up to three different lie detectors. And according to the independent operators, they would pass all of them. Now, the government, though, as we know with them, they're never happy with anything. Nope. They were suspicious of the results. They didn't believe them. They had every reason to believe that Barney Bellomo was on some sort of drug or lithium of some sort, and he passed it illegally. They shave his head. They find no method of believing that that actually happened. And ultimately, they would drop the murder charges. So whether he took a psychiatric drug, we don't know, but it worked, and he passed a lie detector test. Now, as you know, Blackjack, they're not admissible in court, but they are helpful to kind of carrying on things. And ultimately, the murder charges would be dropped, and Barney Bellomo would plead guilty to extortion in the construction industry and get 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, listen, the polygraph thing is an interesting thing, right? Because we know they're not admissible. But the reason they're not admissible is because if you're truly a sociopath, you can pass a polygraph. Like the line from Seinfeld from George Costanza is not inaccurate. If you believe it, it's not a lie. And that's what a polygraph measures, because most people are uncomfortable lying. Some people are not. Some people are fine lying, and it won't measure a noticeable uptick in your blood pressure or anything else. But the fact that they went through these steps with him to shave his head, to test for lithium, and they still gave him the deal tells me that Bellomo probably was telling the truth.
Yeah, and this would actually it would work out because he'd only get 10 years. I mean, it's not the end of the world. He'll do 7 and be out. But this would, quote, enrage James the little guy Ida, who was the concierge of the family. Because the problem that Ida had was he was sick that Bellomo did a plea bargain, but he was also pissed off that he, you know, made sure Domino Generuso did it as well. He didn't want people taking pleas. Not that he had any.
And Jeff, just to interrupt for a second, I have no issue with just to be clear, because we've talked about rats on this show. I have no issue with a guy taking a plea bargain where he doesn't inform on other people. If you just negotiate a lower sentence, I'm fine with that.
Well, but Ida looked at it and said, you know, look, we don't take plea bargains. John Gotti would say that many times.
I know John said, you walk with me, you walk to the wall. I know that's John's philosophy. But if you can shave some time off your sentence by admitting to some shit, so what? It's not, you're not admitting there's a Cosa Nostra. You're not informing on other people. You're talking about your own acts. I don't really have a problem with that.
Sure, I don't either. But Little Jimmy Eata did. He was old school, and he goes behind the scenes to Vince and Gigante and says, listen, I want this guy fucking whacked. I want Belomo dead. He's inspiring other people to do this shit. This is not what we do. And he tried to set up Belomo to be killed in federal prison. They then take Ida, take him to solitary. And Gigante tells him to basically go fuck himself. He's not killing Belomo. Why would he do that? Belomo's this guy. Initially enough, a little Jimmy Eata would actually go to trial in the DiLorenzo murder. They were all indicted on it. He would go to trial and obviously lose. He received a life sentence. Keep in mind, Blackjack, little Jimmy Eata was offered 15 years. He said, no, I'll go to trial. And he will, as of today, he is in FMC Devens. He's 81 years old, and he will die.
Bad business. Just bad
business. He'd have been out a long time ago if he'd have taken the plea. But little Jimmy had to be, you know, an old school guy. So, yeah, again, you know, Barney Belomo was, you know, in jail, but he had a shorter sentence. He was still in control, and he had survived a possible upheaval attempt that never happened. For Barney, it wouldn't end there, though. He would eventually obviously get the 10 years. He was scheduled to come out of prison in 2004. However, in 2001, he would be indicted on money laundering charges related to some involvement on the waterfront. And, you know, Barney was accused of stealing money from pension funds and things of that nature. But also something else would happen, and this would actually add to his sentence. I think he ended up getting 2 years added on, so he did 12 years. But in 2006, this would be the last hurdle Barney Belomo would have, and this would be a problematic thing for him. On February 23rd, 2006, Barney Belomo and 30 family members and associates, including Bronx captain John Buster Ardito, who was 90 years old, would be arrested in a murder indictment involving an individual called Ralph Coppola. Now, Coppola was the acting captain of the 116th Street crew. He was a friend to Barney Belomo. And the complaint would argue around a situation where Peter Peluso, the attorney for Belomo, would go see his client in a New Jersey prison. And according to Peluso, who became a rat, he decides to tell the feds that Belomo instructed him to take a message to Ardito to have Coppola killed. Coppola's killed, and it goes back to Belomo. Now, Peluso would ultimately plead guilty to his role in the murder, but he would basically try to substantiate that Belomo talked to him about this, sent him a message, and he was supposed to go out and make this happen. The problem was there was no proof that any of this ever happened.
Yeah.
And ultimately, again, another murder charge would be dropped, but Belomo would have to deal with another issue. And whether this happened or not, we'll never know because they never recovered Coppola's body. But there's also a weird connection to, you know who Danny Provenzano is, right?
Yep.
There's also a weird connection with him in this as well. It has to do with Belomo's cousin who had the same name, Laborio Belomo, and It's unclear because Provenzano was a Genovese associate at one point. He was involved with a scam involving insurance companies where he would go to Blackjack insurance companies and basically threaten them locally and say, look, I'm connected to Belomo. You better fucking pay. And Provenzano would actually be arrested for this years later. But there were some weird things going on the street involving Belomo, but none of this stuff was ever substantiated. And weirdly enough, you won't believe who helped Belomo with his role in all this. By this point, his daughter Sabrina had become a lawyer, and she is credited for helping her dad get a lighter sentence in a tearful plea to Judge Louis Kaplan. Keep in mind, during the 12-year imprisonment, Barney would miss her high school, college, and law school graduations. And she would discuss that, you know, for the past 11 years, it's been like we've been mourning a person who's alive. We're all kind of strapped in our childhoods. She would talk about her father not being around and that her three brothers, she could get along okay, but it was her younger brothers that were without their father. And, you know, boys are a lot different than girls, especially ones with fathers that were Barney Belomo. she would actually be quite integral, according to reports. And you kind of gave off the Meadow Soprano vibe.
A little bit. I mean, listen, she was a success. She went on to become a lawyer, as you mentioned. And I think that that gives some credence to a judge who listens to a member of the bar and is able to not only give legal insight, but her own personal insight into what it's been to growing up without a father. And at this point, Jeff, he had served a fair amount of time. He served 12 years in prison. So, I mean, it isn't as if, you know, we're talking about a guy who's done a year or two. He's been in prison for a long time. So I think her words certainly weighed on Judge Kaplan.
Yeah, by 2008, Barney Belomo would be released from prison. And since then, he has been on the streets. According to Jerry Capisci, who is a notable mob historian, he would discuss that Belomo, quote, earned substantial rental income every month from numerous apartment buildings worth millions of dollars that he owns in the Bronx and northern suburbs. He also resides, when he is not in New York, at a condo in Miami Beach on Collins Avenue. Quite lucrative, quite nice. He also has financial interests in construction companies that he uses to repair and refurbish rundown apartment buildings he buys. Now, a law enforcement individual that would speak under anonymity would say this about Belomo, quote, "I'm not saying we can prove he's committed a crime, but there's no doubt that he's the boss of the crime family." He would also say that he would decline to answer any specific details, recording key aides that helped Belomo manage the affairs of the largest borgata in the city. Some people believe there are up to 200 people involved in the Genovese crime family at this time. They are a well-oiled machine. They are controlled by an individual who is very careful, who is very smart. He is very cunning. He's a complete leader under every circumstance. And he is the last of the Mohicans. Barney Belomo is a legend in the scheme of things. He is one of the great bosses we've seen in the last 20 years, and he continues the long-standing tradition of the greatest Cosa Nostra family in the history of the country. Go back and look at the long reign of success that the Genoveses continue to crank out. Today, the governing body of the Genovese crime family is Belomo as boss. The underboss is a guy called Ernie Muscarella, who is said to be very trusted by Barney Belomo. Consigliere is unknown. A lot of people believe that it was Petey Red Di Chiara. Petey Red actually died in 2018. But there's still a lot of powerful people in the family, a lot of good captains, good people around. Mickey Ragusa is around. He's the street boss. This is a very still well-oiled family, Blackjack. This guy is very high level. Now, there's an interesting story. Keep in mind, Barney Belomo has four children. He is a widower, Blackjack. His wife died in 2013, and he's just trying to live his life and make sure his kids, especially his sons, don't follow him into a life of crime. Keep in mind, all of his kids have legitimate incomes, legitimate jobs, including his daughter, who is a lawyer up in Pelham in the Bronx. There is a funny story as well. This was a big funny thing in the mob community for a period of time. I don't believe it's still there, but if you go to East 187th Street at Gratona Avenue in the Bronx, at one point there was a street view where you could see Barney Belomo walking out of a pizzeria with his son, and you've seen it, Blackjack.
I have. It's there.
He's carrying a pizza in his hand. And you could see on the street view Barney Belomo with his face blacked out, but it was definitely him.
It absolutely is. And I give him a lot of credit for keeping his kids out of it, because I think that that is something in this day and age that most people would want, right? Like, even if you were involved in Cosa Nostra today, you'd probably not want your kids involved, and it's not what it was 50 years ago. So I give him a lot of credit for raising his children the way he did.
Yeah, that's one thing about the Genoveses you always have to respect as well. I mean, they almost looked at it and said, you know, why would you want to make your kid? You know, you don't want your kid to be something better. And this is the thing with, you know, the future of the mob. And, you know, I'll kind of end it on this. You know, people always ask, you know, what will the mob be in 30, 40, 50 years? Well, people like Barney Belomo won't be around anymore. And the question is, where do we go from here? Because there's an author, George Anastasia, he's a from my area, Philly area. He wrote some great books on the mob, and he's always had a great point about the mob and the current type of people that go into the mob. And he talks about how Blackjack now that Italians want to go in to become doctors and hedge fund managers and businessmen. They don't want to be mobsters. And the mob is, according to George Anastasia, scraping the bottom of the gene pool, as he says. And the people that are going into the life are imbeciles for the most part. They can't walk around without a phone tied to their waist. Yep. You know, this life, I don't think, can continue in this manner. But you have to ask yourself, why can't it? Because
eventually it'll adapt, right? Like, sure. That's the world. Is the mafia is not going to go away. Organized crime is not going to go away. It will ultimately adapt to the world in which it's in. And I don't know what form or shape that will take, but it will adapt. And there will be someone that will come along that will lead that transition and will take the mob into the 21st century. But it's not going to go away entirely. It won't. I don't think it'll ever reach back to its heyday, but it's not going to go away. But, you know, it's going to have to change with the times.
Keep in mind, as I said, Barney Bellomo is on the street, allegedly. He is 64 years old, so still pretty young in the grand scheme of things. I always also got one kick out of Bellomo. There was a situation at one point where there's not a lot of pictures of Bellomo, if you've noticed.
No.
There's actually a really funny situation where he's actually complained about some of the pictures out there of him. He doesn't like the one picture that's out there of him standing in the University of Paris shirt. He doesn't like that.
I wouldn't like it either.
He's complained about that. But that's how you know a gangster is a gangster, because you know, you go back to like the 20s, there might not be pictures of somebody, but like, bro, Barney Bellomo, it's 2021, and what are there, like 3 or 4 photos of him?
I know, you're right.
Like, it's crazy. That's a guy that stays behind the scenes. So there you go. Barney Bellomo on the sit down, a fascinating individual. We don't talk much about the current leadership. And again, all this is just alleged. We're not the FBI. We just talk about the history of the American mob, but a fascinating person nonetheless. I'll be interested to see kind of how this all shakes out down the road with Barney Bellomo. As always, thanks for listening to the show. Blackjack, great as always. Always enjoy your legal takes. That's something we need here. Next week, we've got a good show planned for you. We're going to talk about Frank Costello. And I'm excited about that because Frank Costello is a really interesting guy. He had some really fascinating things to say about the mob. Obviously, he was connected with Chin Gigante towards the end of his life, as we know, the very publicized hit. So a good episode next week, and we'll keep cranking out the good mob content. As always, please follow us on Twitter at TheSitDown7. And if you enjoy the show, please give us a rating on iTunes or Spotify and leave us a comment. Let us know what you think of our show. We greatly appreciate it. Blackjack, we are up over 600,000 listens. We are getting closer to 1 million. What's the over-under on 1 million listens?
New Year's.
New Year's? You think we could do it by then?
I do. Frank Costello is going to be a big one.
Yeah, I mean, we still have plenty of good episodes. You know, and again, we've got so many people still to do. So it is a great time to be alive. As I said, mark your calendars. The week of December 10th, we will not be having a show. But I guess we deserve a week off. I got a busy time during then. So there you go. All right, Blackjack, good stuff. As always, we will talk to you next week. And as always, thank you for listening to The Sit Down. We'll be back next week.